Lionel Hutt, Real 30.
Right, just two little things I forgot on the where we're talking about Burma, because it was a lot of anecdotes really, but if you take the time scale of why I was there, two things related that I borrowed a Sentinel aircraft from the Kazivax people, who actually flew over the hump to go into China later on, and they were conscientious objectors, and they were nice people, and they were good pilots, and they flew as casualty evacuations, where the aircraft were made up with a stretcher, and I told you about the Tiger Moth as well. But an interesting aspect of that is that most of the people that they took out with Tiger Moths were blacks from East Africa, from the East African Regiment of Artillery. And if they got shot and they got the bullet in the bum or something like that, and they taken from the casual station to be evacuated quickly to an upgraded place where they got nurses and everything else. And so you imagine a situation where you have an African who, even when he sailed on a ship, thought it was on running on rails under the water, and he's now been taught the Christian principles that when you die you go to heaven, and when you're heaven that's where everything is right and blah blah blah, and everybody's dressed in white. And I give you a situation which is quite interesting, because when these boys got a bullet in their bums, they were taken through for evacuation. And usually, because they were East Africans, for some reason they didn't find themselves getting the American aircraft. They got the English aircraft with the Tiger Moths. A Tiger Moth would take one person. It had been converted to take one stretcher with a lid on the top of it. So you put the stretcher in sideways, and then we put the lid down. And so you here have a situation where a black native has been told of Christian is that when you die, you go to heaven and you go to God, and it's up there, and you know, life's beautiful. So he's now on a stretcher and is not feeling very well. So they take him to an aeroplane, which he's never seen, never flown in before in his life, and never had anything to do with whatsoever, on his stretcher, and he's put into this aircraft, and they close the side doors and pull the leaf down, and he's sitting in an aeroplane. And the aeroplane takes off. He'd never been in an aeroplane before, and it bumps across the grass field, and it's in the air and flying around, and flies 10 minutes, 20 minutes, who knows. And it comes back and lands another airplane, another place. And it landed, and the people come to collect him, to take him to the hospital, take his bullet out of his bum. And what would be the first person he'd see when he comes off that aircraft? It'd be a nurse dressed in white, and he'd think he'd gone to heaven. Can you imagine? And that's it's the sort of way that these kids think, you know. They'd no idea. I mean, a railway train or the water got rails. And so that's one thing. And the other thing, of course, was the Akiab business. Now, bear in mind, and we're talking about pre-Christmas 1944. I've flown over Akiab. There's nothing there. And as far as I'm concerned, that's my job finished, I'm going home. It wasn't until many years later that I found out, when he saw his obituary, so it's quite recently I saw his obituary actually, that a pilot from the Royal Artillery in February of 1945, when the war had moved right down to Ramree, was flying over there, and it flew over the airfield like I did, but now there was people there, and they came out waving the knickers and waving white flags, and they landed on the airfield Nobody had ever wanted to land there and ever been there before. And he took over the airfield. This was two months after the war had gone miles away. And he got a DFC for it. The RAF gave him a DFC. I thought to myself, dearie, dearie, dearie me.
So should we take the story up where you were trying to get back to Colombo?
Right, so I've gone up to an airfield, and I'm a little bit hazy about the actual airfields, but I was at one where there was the army and the Americans, paratroopers, who were going somewhere doing some exercise, and it must have been, but I was on the grassy part of it, and I don't remember it being an airfield, but it must have been, obviously. But I was sitting around doing nothing. I was my own time, and so obviously I was aware I was being fed and watered. Which again is another story on the way back. But there were super forts there, and one of the blokes said he was going over the hump into China. I said, well, I can do anything I want to. I say, can I have a trip? And they flew over the hump into China and landed at near Lake Ho or something, Lake Ho, near a lake. And what the boys did, they took as much soap as they could take over at the hump for trading, and toothpaste. The Chinese wanted toothpaste for some reason, and soap and toothpaste is very prominent. And went in there just to touch and go, and then he came back again. What they were doing, I know not. And it was one single aeroplane, and I had a trip in it, so I had to go in a super fort as well. So that was a nice one. But then I was trying to get back, and I was obviously to fly down. Again, this is vagary coming cropping in, but I flew in a DC-3, and I flew from there to Dum Dum for Calcutta, and this is another anecdote. Now, we all know about Lawrence of Arabia, and that he went and he went all the way across the desert. It's rather like that again, because I arrived in an aeroplane at an airfield to stay in the officer's mess in Calcutta, or where is it? Dum Dum, I think it was, which was the Palace of the Raj, all marble and shiny domes and everything else, everybody dressed in immaculate uniforms, all polished white and clean. Oh, sorry, I missed a part of the story, because amongst those people, when I was with the paratroopers, I met up with my two pals from West Africa, who had taken the West African Frontier Force all the way round, and they'd been in the box, and we joined together to travel back by air back to Ceylon. And they were not happy bunnies. They got the uniforms that they had when they left 2 years ago, still wearing, and they were pale shadows themselves. They looked very, very poorly. And I told you about the native boy, didn't I? When you saw a native boy who had been in there, how they changed colour. And we went off to fly back together now, blood brothers really, and we flew into Calcutta. And we went into the officer's mess to stay the night and have a meal. So we went into the place, and there was water and goods and everything else, but we only had the clothes we stood up in. We had nothing at all. And we came down into the mess, washed and polished, but still in our scruffies. And I was in junglies, and that I still got my bloody gun round my belt, because if I lost that, I had to pay for it, you know. And we walked into that mess, and they didn't want to know us. And we were going to have a meal there, have a dinner, and we had a table, and they actually put a screen round us in the mess. But I never forget that. The two of us had a good meal, but we walked into there just like we were pariahs, and they were, I mean, their uniforms, they'd been messing around in them. They never got washed or anything, and there was I was just rough, you know, just... I mean, I'd been living virtually rough for, a week, 10 days, more than that. But I was, that was the essence of that. And that was a lovely story I tell, because we came down we went in the mess. They told us where we can have a wash and shave. And that was the only contact that anybody ever had. And they were all in their posh uniform, all polished up and, you know, living the life of, you know, the Raj Riley. And when we came, we sat down for a meal, and we sat down at the table, and the table was part of the mess until they separated us with a screen around us. They're unbelievable. So we flew back. I went back to the same airfield later on after the war in Bangladesh Bimum airline from... They had another airfield. They had the airplane, and they only had one. And we flew into Dum Dum in this airline, and we're all together in a big, I don't know what it was, a 747 probably. And when we left, the 747, the Bangladesh scene, was down the side of the runway, wrecked. And we flew into Dum Dum, and we arrived there. And we were taken ashore. This is peacetime. They wouldn't pay us any feed us or anything. Wouldn't give us any food. They wanted us to stay the night in a wooden hut with wooden seats while they got a replacement. And we'd still be there if the people in Bangladesh didn't want some money, and the financial minister wanted to go back. So we got the aircraft again to fly. That was in England, to fly ourselves then. But otherwise, they were so rough, they would have left us there forever. We were passionate in, they wanted to fly Mecca. That's right. They wanted one aircraft to fly to Mecca, and when it came back, he wanted this aircraft, so he got it. You know, just unbelievable that the things.
A contrast between 1945
and when we were there. Yeah. So that was an interesting one. But then we set off back in a DC-3, flying down really from Dum Dum, down the coast through Vizag, I think, all the way in a DC-3, which is it was a roughie. It wasn't sitting in nice seats. It was benches and everything else. We got all the way to Ceylon, and then I went to Colombo, see the movements, and to get on a ship. And I don't remember a great deal about that. All I know that I was going to sail on a ship.
Was it relatively...
Yes. What happened was that... When I got back, I only had civilian clothes, and those civilian clothes had been kept for me for the wardroom.
Is that because all your stuff was sent on?
All my stuff had been on board. You see, all my heavy stuff and everything else. I'd only got civvies, and. So, I got down there, and civvies went down to movements, and they put me on a ship to go home, which was a troop ship. Well, not a troop ship, but a civilian ship with all the trimming and everything else. And one little story about that was that in order to go home, it's an anecdote more than anything else. I had to go take some presents back for my wife, and I'd been paid by that time because I'd been come back and I was owed money. So I went up to the little fishing village that I first went to when I first went to Ceylon on the way up to Putlam, and a jeweller used to go there selling good jewellery, and I took a fancy to an opal necklace with a big black opal at the bottom, and I knew nothing at all about jewellery. It looked pretty, and I thought I'd have that. And a voice out there said, "You don't want to buy opals, they're unlucky." So I didn't buy it. The fellow who told me happened to be an RAF flight lieutenant who was going back on the same ship. And when we came back to England, we all met together with his girlfriend and my wife in London. We had a flat in Eaton Square, actually, at a Muse place. And what do you think his girlfriend was wearing around her neck? And I told my wife about this opal, and she went ape. It's a big black opal, cost nothing really, a super piece of kit. And I've lived with that for the rest of my life. That I'd bought some. I recently went back to Australia and thought I'd take some opals back, one for my secretary and one for my wife. And I got two black opals, they're triplets, so beautiful pieces of kit, and brought them both back. And you'd say that opal is unlucky. First of all, I'm unlucky because I didn't buy the damn things. I'm unlucky when I bought two, one for my wife and one secretary. And secretary got the best one, didn't she? Because she went to proper jeweller and had it mounted properly. And her, Dorothy, designed her own jewellery in the front. She designed one with a claw fix. And that's why opals are unlucky, if you didn't know. Because you don't put a claw fitting on an opal, because it's very fragile, and the movement of the metal in temperatures will squeeze and track it. So that's not quite true as far as triplets are concerned, because when you do a triplet, it's got a hard base to it, which will take the things. The ones that I bought my wife weren't triplets, they were black opals, and they're worth a bomb. But Jan wears hers all the time. Dorothy didn't wear hers, so she was angry.
So, were there any stories of coming back on the troop ship? Anything that?
Oh yes, that was quite good, really, because that was a holiday journey, really a cruise par excellence, a good ship. Coming back with a mixed bag of people, but coming back we used to. We had a routine each day to pass the day. Well, we got up and had boat drill, and then had breakfast, and then I think we played chess. We played mahjong. Played mahjong all the time, and when lights went out and everything else, we played crap dice with all the troops at the back, and. That was a holy, really. It was a real jolly. And I did manage to do something. Again, I'm unique in many things. But if you play mahjong, I've done the ultimate, which is like getting running flush 14 times on the trot. I picked the moon out of the bottom, which fixed the whole lot. That's known as moon, taking the moon from the bottom of the ocean. It's number one of numbers, I think. And that made up my set. And that pays in Chinese terms mega money, mega, mega money indeed. And we did the usual thing. I got home. The trip was really uneventful. The war was quietening down there. We had a few mines were dropped on the way back. And we're coming back at Christmas time as well. So it was, it wasn't Christmas, was it then?
January
4th. It wasn't Christmas, though. That came into Liverpool so often. Came into Liverpool again.
Maybe January, February 45, you'd be getting.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It would be. It was cold, wasn't it? Because I remember every time I went from Liverpool to Hull, it was freezing bloody cold. And all I had in the wide world of what I stood up in, I lost it all playing poker. And on the way back, that was twice I did that. I lost it coming back from Canada, and then that takes it all the way back. But of course, to compound all this, as more or less a tail end to the story, unless you want to put anything else onto it, is that I sent my wife a telegram when I was on the ship saying I was coming home, and she could never believe that I hadn't volunteered for all these things. She never did. And there's a letter there, even in my thing. We've seen it, haven't you? The telegram.
So can you tell me now, then, really, one last question?
Yeah.
How do you feel now about having served with the Fleet Air Arm?
The best thing to me happened in my life, without question. I have more friends from the Fleet Air Arm. If it was a band of brothers, and once you've been in the Fleet Air Arm, it doesn't matter whether you are RN or RNVR. You're one of a crowd, and it's a band of brothers that you can't break.